ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration,
and energy. I'd just like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Behrendt.
It's a fresh view coming
on ABC Radio.
We're looking back on the past 12 months in Indigenous affairs. This is Speaking Out. I'm Larissa Behrendt. This year saw a mix of hard-won progress and ongoing challenges. There have been changes in the local, national and international political landscape, the signing of a landmark treaty in Victoria and youth crime reform. In an historic first, we saw the conviction of a police officer in relation to the death in custody of an Indigenous teenager. And just a warning, we will be discussing subjects that may be distressing to some listeners. Joining me to reflect on the key moments over the past 12 months are journalist and industry professor Lorena Allam and director of research at the Jumbana Institute, Professor Lyndon Coombs. Well, welcome back to Speaking Out, a yearly tradition to have you here with us doing the year in review. And looking back, I guess perhaps the place to start, one of the big events of the year, which has really shaped Australia, the 2025 election. Lyndon, where were you on the night and were you surprised? In fact, probably the question is, how surprised were you?
Yeah, I had a reasonably quiet one for election night. I live at Marrickville, went down to Marrickville West, got there at the time that Albo was putting his vote in. So,
well, maybe a bit of an omen.
I thought that might have been an omen. But yeah, nice and quiet. But I probably thought Labor would get it, but it was a smashing. I think it's the most seats that the ALP has won. I just never thought it would be that decisive. And, you know, there wasn't even really a lot of tension in the coverage. It was picked up pretty quick, had the ALP people just absolutely wallowing in it, giving it to the Libs from very early on. So it was going to be a long night for the Libs very early.
And Lorena, do you have a ritual when you watch the election, and what were your feelings and emotions and what surprised you most?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking it's been a while in terms of news, the volume of news since the election. It's almost hard to remember. But our tradition, now that my kids are of voting age, is that we go as a family and vote and partake of a democracy sausage. There was a democracy sausage dog at our voting booth that
nice,
was part of the
nice
AEC
one.
Team, which was pretty nice, little sausage dog running around. And I love that atmosphere of, like, it's a family thing and, you know, the schools have fetes and stuff. So I love that we make sure that it's something to celebrate. And so we cast our vote and didn't think. We thought Labor might get up, but not by the majority that they got. It was quite astonishing. And even Anthony Green was surprised, and that's quite a good barometer of how unexpected the win was. And since then, obviously, the coalition has just been in disaster mode. They're just reeling from it, still not sure what that means for their future policies. But Labor is just, it's a very decisive victory, a huge mandate for Albo. And I guess these months down the track, we're just waiting to see what they really are going to do with that.
Let's dig into the impact a little bit more. Obviously, one of the surprises on the night, I guess you could say, was that Dutton did lose his seat. And from your perspective, Lyndon, Lorena's spoken about the chaos that has ensued since then. But what have been your observations on the overall impact of that election loss on the coalition as they've tried to find their feet?
Yeah, it's really depleted them and I think confused them as well, even now. They're really struggling. They're struggling with their identity. They don't seem to have taken the message of being too far to the right. I think they sort of felt like we should go further to the right, a bit like the English cricket team, thinking they should be more aggressive. But every other metric is telling them something else and they're not doing it. And you can't help but think that Susan Ley is an interim leader. I'd be very surprised if she contests the next election as their leader. And it's permeated through the states as well. There's New South Wales, Victoria, lots of disruption for them. So, yeah, they're not in a good place.
What are your observations, Lorena, on that?
Well, we've just been through what the Libs call their killing season. As Lyndon says, they've replaced a bunch of leaders in the states, like Mark Speakman here in New South Wales. So they're trying everything, they're throwing everything at this. But I do think they're ignoring some major trends in the community, which are around the environment, and their policy on energy is so out of touch with the electorate. So and also the media they're getting is really challenging. They're not landing their attacks. Lee's had a few taken aim a few times, and it's not really gone well for her. The attack on Albo for his Joy Division T-shirt just backfired. There's, you know, of late, they're not really landing on, in terms of the travel expenses issue that's current now. So I don't know. And the media they're getting is, you know, the coalition could be facing oblivion. That's not easy to respond to publicly. And, you know, the very public defection of Barnaby Joyce to One Nation, potentially to find himself a comfortable seat in the Senate. But also, you know, so all of those things just don't bode well for their future.
I was going to ask you about that too. The one thing that has occurred since the election, there is obviously a reinforcement of the mantra from many moderate conservatives about the fact that you win elections from the centre. But we've seen this huge rise in the polling of the popularity amongst sectors of the electorate of One Nation. And I wonder what your reflections are on that.
I haven't really drilled down into what those numbers represent, but I do think it's kind of right-leaning coalition voters who don't like where they're going under Lee and feel like they can't support Labor. They don't want to support Labor. But if you look at the field of potential people to throw your campaign behind, it's limited. You know, so I think that's people are going to One Nation. It's interesting, this is the anniversary of the Cronulla riots. So I think also that racism and race politics in Australia is still very much driving our public conversation, and it's pretty much it's present in Parliament. I mean, Pauline Hanson wore a niqab in Parliament again this year and was censured for it. So I mean, when's this ridiculous stuff going to end? In fact, I think we're facing a future where this stuff becomes more polarising and more common. In New South Wales, there was a lot of soul searching about how it was that right-wing Nazis were allowed to protest outside state parliament and given police approval. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on the right that we should all be very concerned about. And I think it's time for the federal government to convene a meeting to look at how we deal with race hate in the community. I think it's there, you know, and now's the time with this big majority. They have an opportunity to drive some public policy, and they have a moral responsibility to do that.
Lyndon, I'm interested in your thoughts in this space too. You do a lot of work in the anti-racism area.
Yeah, when there's, I guess, a lot of people would perceive Albanese as a progressive government. It's not my personal opinion, but when there seems to be a steady ship, a progressive administration that's sort of holding the line, so I'm thinking of Obama, that's when this stuff seems to fester, because their usual go-tos is not aiming up and they want something else, and they really don't like Albo and his Joy Division T-shirt and his dog and his now wife. And so, not a psychologist, but it just seems that sort of calmness or steadiness provides a bit of fertility for these people to come up with, you know, some very weird things, and maybe, you know, the worst part of themselves gets expressed out of their frustration. But I agree with Lorena that it's something to keep an eye on, and allowing that group to protest outside Parliament House, I think, you know, it's giving up those little things that gives them that encouragement as well.
And just picking up another observation that Lorena made that would be great to get your thoughts on is, of course, Barnaby Joyce's defection from the Nationals to One Nation. Is this going to be an asset or a liability?
Probably both.
It can be both.
He seems to, you know, get the numbers in. So that retail politician, a bit like Bob Catter, they know their electorate. Their electorate knows them and what they're getting. Seem to like it for whatever reason. So yeah, I think he'll do that. He'll continue to be a broader embarrassment, I think, for the Parliament. I don't see that behaviour changing. I don't think he's been anywhere near as contrite as perhaps he should have been for a whole range of things. But, yeah, I wouldn't want to be in that company, but he'll offer them something but take something away at the same time, I think.
The observation was made that Indigenous issues didn't feature prominently in the election campaigning, and nor did it feature strongly in the election night speeches as it did upon Albanese's first win when he started with an embrace of the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Just wonder, Lorena, in looking back over the time since the referendum at the national level, what your observations are on the state of the conversation around First Nations policy?
Well, publicly, there is no conversation that I can perceive on the federal level. There's plenty of stuff going on in the states. But in terms of the federal level, the idea that they just don't want to touch Indigenous affairs. It's all steady hand, closing the gap, measurable outcomes, you know, results, 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 and they want to stick to that narrative. They don't want to talk about truth-telling or any big-picture ideas. On election night, you know, Albo, the first thing he did was offer an acknowledgement of country, which was his kind of repudiation of the culture war that we had had in the lead-up to the election, driven by Dutton, about the symbolic nature of welcomes to country. And I don't even want to get into the ridiculous arguments around that stuff. At the moment, we're in this phase where we're kind of recovering and regrouping and rethinking how to navigate this new landscape. Post-referendum, it's been seismic. Like, it's had a huge impact on us as from the personal, individual level all the way up to how we imagine ourselves as part of the nation. So it's been a really difficult time. It's frustrating that the federal government doesn't seem to want to engage on those big picture things, because now, as, like, you know, they've got such a big majority, they could really have an impact. And instead they're focusing on small things, policy changes, you know, measurable outcomes. Some of them are incredibly important initiatives. Building laundrettes in remote communities in the Northern Territory is really important. It means people can wash their clothes. It reduces the chance of skin disease. And then, by extension, rheumatic heart fever and rheumatic heart disease, which we know is fatal for our kids up there. So there's stuff like that that's happening, but it's not big ticket stuff. It's measurable, kind of small, achievable steps rather than some big overarching vision.
Lyndon, what's been your observation in that space? And I'm particularly interested because I know you've done a lot of work around closing the gap. But in terms of those broader conversations as well, what's been your reflection on the state of Indigenous affairs at the national level as a result of the referendum?
Yeah, it's I think that the government certainly is a bit more careful around Indigenous affairs following the referendum, sticking to sort of the close the gap work. And we were fortunate enough to do the first ever Indigenous-led review of that earlier this year through Jumbunna. And getting out and talking to people, it felt like one of the first times since the referendum that people felt a degree of comfort in coming out and talking again. You got the feeling that mob was sort of dusting themselves off after, you know, a period of hurt and disappointment and disillusionment. I think we've been pretty good as a people at dealing with disappointment, but that one seemed to strike particularly hard. So it was actually good to get out and talk to people across the country about closing the gap. And whenever you go out to talk about one thing, you're going to talk about a lot of other things. And that was the sort of feeling and sense I got from community, that they were happy, even though the Close the Gap is framed in deficit language, they were happy to have conversations about something more positive and ways in which they can do things better. So we're also finding that with treaty in New South Wales. We've, at Jumbunna, been asked to be a research partner to the treaty commissioners here in New South Wales. So we've been out about six hubs across New South Wales. And again, there's that feeling of dusting themselves off, coming out and sort of having a non-deficit conversation. And it's taken all that time, I think, post-referendum, but it still looms over those discussions. And when we go out and we're talking about treaty, it often comes up, well, we're going to have all these discussions and it's going to come to nothing. So certainly the spectre of that failed referendum still remains.
Just might pick up, one of the things I love about having you two on the show for our year in review is not only do you have great opinions about what's happening, very insightful observations, but you're both out in the field doing things. So I just want to take the opportunity. We've spoken about how there's little appetite for the big picture at the national level from the government. But Lorena, you're so active in the truth-telling space with your journalism and the other work that you do. And by the way, congratulations on that next Walkley that you've just got this year. Well-deserved for that kind of work. But I guess it'd be interesting to get your reflections, even though there isn't a national government-led conversation around truth-telling. From your perspective, being out in the community, what is the appetite and what is the action happening in that space at that level?
The appetite is huge. Everywhere we go, people talk about truth-telling as the one thing, and the truth listening is an important factor. They're ready to come to terms with, you know, the way that this country was violently colonised. We're reporting all of this information. It's not like anyone can say, oh, we didn't know anymore. We do know. We do know now. So the question is, what are we going to do about it? And truth-telling processes are really important to people. They want to be able to speak their truth, have it recorded for future generations, and be heard. That's just the start of a process, because truth-telling should lead to change that's determined by individuals and communities, right? And when I'm out in the field and the work that I have done, particularly this year with The Guardian on the Descendants Project, listening to people in communities, the most important thing for them is the local truth-telling. It makes the most impact for them when they are able to be on country with, even if it's the descendants of the perpetrators of the violence. You know, these people, they pass in the street every day in these towns, and it's just replicated all over Australia. So I think the localised truth-telling is often much more powerful, much more meaningful and more lasting than any kind of big picture processes. Those things are important, I think, in a public, a civic education way, to as a record for us to all learn and to know as this is the agreed truth of our history. That stuff's really important. But the most meaningful, lasting stuff, I think, happens person to person. So I think when we talk about truth-telling, that stuff is happening. And I'm meeting non-Indigenous people who are doing research into their own family history and finding stuff that they are really, really distressed about, and not knowing what to do with that information. And while I don't think we should centre or privilege non-Indigenous people in the truth-telling conversation, the fact that they're game enough to look should be encouraged and endorsed, because eventually they will come to understand that, as we know from the way we live, is that a price was paid for their relative wealth and their relative privileges. And the question, the ultimate question of truth-telling is, well, how do we rectify that fact of history? What do we do now to alleviate the disadvantage over generations of Indigenous people?
Before we move off the national agenda, our reflections on that, I don't want to fall into the trap. I think one of the things that we've seen with the chaos for the coalition since the election is perhaps not the same measure of attention to what the Albanese government's doing. But I'd love to get your thoughts, and maybe start with you, Lyndon, on how you think they've gone post-election in their second iteration, and what you think would be some of the things that you might point to as some highlights or some things that they need to watch.
That's a tough one. As I was saying, I think it's sort of a steady-as-she-goes approach, and it seems to be working for them. So we talked about the margin that they had before. It just feels like it's a small target strategy. Little policies here and there, the under 16 social media bans just kicked in. And I remember when they announced that, I just thought, why are you doing this in a lead up to the election? It was something that, you know, I felt like it was a bit of a gift to Peter Dutton at the time. You know, the general liberal philosophy being about freedom and liberty and being able to do whatever you like, you know, low regulation, all that sort of stuff. But they did it. And I think it's just a lot of maybe little things like that, even though, you know, I got young kids and very aware of the harm that social media can cause. And while it's, you know, a good thing to do politically, I just thought that wasn't a smart move. But I'm often wrong. They weathered that and just continue on. As we were saying before, it seems like Susan Ley hasn't laid a glove on Albanese. Anything they try to do just comes up short. It looks a bit lame. So that seems to be working for them. And they're probably, as a result, not motivated to take on maybe some bigger picture issues. So maybe a third term, we'll get the big picture.
What are your views, Lorena, and also your thoughts? I mean, your children aren't young anymore. We've already confessed they're a voting age, but you have had young children and worked in the media, you know, the harms of social media. So in terms of that as a policy, what were your thoughts? And then more broadly, what do you think about how the Albanese government's travelling?
Well, I've got mixed views on the social media ban. I mean, I think it's quite ambitious. In a way, it's easier. Then, I mean, I can't imagine how important this job has been for Julie Inman Grant and the minister, but it's easier than taking on the social media giants and dealing with their lies and misinformation and the AI slop we get served on these platforms. So, I mean, for me, I think cleaning up the platforms is more important than banning our kids from them, because, I mean, most of our kids have pretty media savvy, and that is where they get their news from. So we want our kids to be informed. We need to be able to feel more confident that the platforms they use are taking better steps to clean up their act and provide them with quality content. Now, that might sound very Pollyanna-ish, it probably is, but I think that the ban has been a good thing for parents, because for too long, and certainly that was my experience, was I was the last line of defence between my kids and harmful content on the internet. And you being the policeman of these apps that have, you know, whole teams dedicated to how to get around parents and how to get your kids' attention in the middle of the night, you know, so that, and the bullying and exposure to harmful content. So, I mean, my kids weaned themselves off social media themselves. They learnt that it was, They figured out that it was toxic, but I do wonder the damage that it's done in the meantime. And there's downsides to every kind of blanket ban like this. There are kids who will miss out, kids with, you know, neurodivergent kids with disabilities who rely on the internet as a form of contact with the outside world and with their mates. The ban on YouTube means now that kids are accessing mainstream YouTube with ads, and the parents don't have control over that any longer. They don't have the parental controls that they used to have. So there's downsides to it as well. I think Albo is very good at wedging the opposition, and he has managed to introduce and get through policies that they can't really object to. I mean, if you oppose a social media ban on the kiddies, you know, what does that make you look like? You know, you look out of touch, you look... and it does kind of wedge them because of that libertarian kind of principle that they live by. So I think he's really smart at, you know, neutralising the opposition while putting, you know, getting through policies and legislation that look like a win without really tackling the bigger problem.
We've mentioned the treaty process in New South Wales. Just looking at some of the things that have been in the news over the last year around the states, of course, high on that agenda would be what Victoria's achieved with its treaty process, its recent apology. Lyndon, what's been your observation? I know you've watched that jurisdiction closely.
Yeah, they've kind of set the roadmap, certainly for New South Wales. Here in New South Wales, we're just literally starting out by going out and talking to community, asking them if they do want a treaty, and if so, what that might look like. The whole time, we've obviously had an eye on the Victorian process, but that's the result of almost two decades worth of work, and that's, I think, the lesson that we're taking here, and probably a lesson from the referendum. So the commissioners are going out to communities and saying, you know, do you want this? Rather than being presented with an already decided outcome or already decided options. And I think that was probably a step that was missed in the referendum was, here's this thing, yes or no. And we saw the fallout from that. So, yeah, obviously looking at Victoria, it has taken a bit of political courage, and you'd hope that that would be replicated here in New South Wales. There's an election coming up in just over a year, in March 27. And yeah, it does take some courage to stick to that. It's one of those issues that, as I said, probably the opposition would use or weaponise, but we know it's the right thing to do, and hopefully seeing that pathway in Victoria and not being under any illusions about the timeframe as well. And the other thing is to just start talking about it with a bit more maturity. You know, we're the only country, I think, in the Commonwealth, possibly in the world, with an Indigenous population that doesn't have a treaty. So we're clearly an outlier. But treaty just seems such a controversial issue here. So hopefully we get to have good, calm, mature conversations and work towards an outcome.
Lorena, we saw the changing of the Northern Territory government, and of course Queensland as well. Both have stopped treaty processes, but have also had very strong tough on crime agendas. This is also a space that you've worked in a lot, and you've got very strong ties across the territory from the work that you've done there. What have been your observations about the impact of those changes of government?
Well, we've seen the impact in overcrowding in youth detention, and I mean the overcrowding in adult detention, particularly for women. That's like 99% First Nations people. Getting tough on crime means criminalising our mob for sleeping in the long grass and being, things that should have been struck out of the criminal code a long time ago, like public drunkenness and, you know, moving people on. So those, I mean, we've already seen it. There's jails are overflowing with our people. The opposite should be happening. We really, you know, they're taking us back. The last, I think this week, the stats on deaths in custody are an obscene, that it's the worst it's been in 40 years. So, I mean, it's hard not to notice that we're talking about treaties and truth-telling on one hand, and the other hand, these stats are getting worse and worse by the year. We can see it happening in New South Wales with the highest, we've got the highest prison population in the country of Indigenous people in New South Wales in jail. You know, we're 3.8% of the population, but more than a third of the country's prisoners. It's obscene. And Queensland has abandoned its truth-telling process. It doesn't want a treaty process. It's locking up Aboriginal kids at alarming rates in watch houses, and long-term incarceration in watch houses that really are only meant to be holding people for a few hours. We've got kids in there for weeks on end, kids who are being deprived of sunlight, you know, are incarcerated 23 out of 24 hours every day, ignoring things like decriminalising public drunkenness and banning chokeholds by police in arrests and in prisons, banning spit hoods, and the Walpree campaign to disarm the police. All those things are just being ignored, and we are seeing the results of it nationally.
Also probably not on the cheery side, depending on where you sit politically, but we've just seen the first year of Trump's second presidency. Lyndon, I wonder what your reflections have been on his impact internationally and nationally in the US.
Yeah, it was probably all of the democratic fears come to life. Certainly creating a lot of chaos with the tariffs. He still doesn't seem to understand what a tariff is. He's reducing, claims to be reducing drug prices by 500, 600, 700%. So he doesn't understand percentages. And he's looking incredibly frail. And he's surrounded himself with people that don't seem to be up to the job. Kash Patel with the FBI, others in the administration that he's sort of plucked from Fox News, Pete Hegseth, the Department of War, now not the Department of Defence. It just seems utter chaos. And I think that there's a method to that madness, and that's enrichment. I'm astounded at and quite fearful of the consolidation of wealth to the billionaires. You know, he's chummed up with Elon Musk, Bezos, everyone, all the billionaires are in there, snout in the trough, and it's pretty frightening. RFK Jr. with health, anti-vaccines, I think he's trying to get fluoride out of water. It's like a zoo. Every day I sort of turn on, and just this morning the president had an entire screed on his Truth Social platform claiming that he's aced three cognitive tests just recently. He had an MRI. He can't remember where the MRI was on what body part. It's just a soap opera every day, but you feel that there's real damage being caused in amongst that chaos. The government shutdown affected people's access to food stamps. It appears quite frightening, but at the same time it feels like something's got to give. It just seems too chaotic to continue for another 3 years.
Often overlooked are our Maori friends in New Zealand, just as we look back on the year that was. It's been a tough year for them as the New Zealand government has sought to really pull back a lot of Maori rights and a lot of recognition that the Maori have. Lyndon, what's been your observation about that trend, and what do you think the impacts could be for the Maori?
Yeah, again, concerning, and certainly from our lens of treaty. You know, treaty is not a new, we've just started this conversation in New South Wales, but it's not a new request. You know, our people have been asking for that for hundreds of years. And we often look towards Aotearoa as a template and say, gee, I wish we had that. And I remember a Māori academic saying, be very careful what you wish for. You know, it's not all it's, you know, mucked up to be. And that's why they have the tribunal. But it's a sobering lesson for us as we talk about treaty, that it's always fragile. It always has to be fought for. And I guess what we've learned is treaty is not a destination. It's a constant battle. And once you get treaty rights, you know, you got to keep fighting. It's a tiring thought to think that, you know, people fight so hard to get those rights and then, you know, think they can put their feet up, but you can't. It's a constant battle for Indigenous people to maintain their rights. So in that sense, you know, lots of love and solidarity to our brothers and sisters over there, but also a very keen lesson for us here as we have those discussions as well.
Interested in your thoughts on that, Lorena, too, and I guess that bigger picture, that this idea that somehow rights are something that you take two steps forward and one step back. You've been working in the space a long time. I wonder what your reflections are on that.
Yeah, well, we do look to New Zealand and Aotearoa and think, oh, well, you know, they're lucky they signed that treaty, or good for them they signed that treaty back then, because it would be really difficult to settle that same, make that same arrangement today. And that's what we're struggling with, is we're more than a century behind in terms of, you know, and having to unpick all of the damage of colonisation and try and negotiate something as sovereign peoples, as equals, with these governments that have had time to establish themselves. So as Lyndon said, we look to Aotearoa and we think, gee, you know, you Maori's got it, you know, you've got a really good deal over there. But these last few years, watching Maori politicians, then they've been fierce. Like, they've been amazing at their defence of Waitangi, and the things that they have said, and the actions that they have arranged in Parliament, that has, those sort of visuals have gone around the world, and that's what I've seen, you know, showing their sovereign power through language and song and making strong statements. We're still at the point where we're talking about what we might want from a process that might lead to a treaty in the future. So we're a long way from that. But we can look to these other countries and learn from where they've gone, and maybe it will bring something for our mob, maybe our kids' generation or further ahead, that is a benefit to them. And you know, I feel like I'd much rather defend a right than have to get it. So if we can leave that for them, I reckon that would be good.
Well, looking back on our discussion so far, there's been probably more negatives than positives. But as the great Peter Yu, friend of the show, says, Aboriginal people are optimists because it's you don't want to imagine what the alternative is. So looking forward with that hopeful, optimistic First Nations gaze, I wonder if you could share with us, if you had a magic wand or you get to write the policy, what would you hope to see in Indigenous affairs in 2026? Lyndon?
I'd like to see economic prosperity in a cultural way, in a collective way. I think lots of economic policies aimed at Indigenous people sort of boil down to people being thrown high-vis vests and thinking that's part of it, but, you know, having a serious discussion about utilising enormous land assets across the country and, yeah, I guess fulfilling a bit of the potential that's there economically and, as I say, in a cultural way. And the other one is just because it's been close to my heart recently, languages. I was on the Aboriginal Languages Trust. My term ended earlier this year. We did our Uwalaroi Certificate 1, which was a brilliant process. And I recently did another podcast on Aboriginal languages, and the work being done there is superb. The Guardian's just starting another series around that, which is, again, awesome. The Indigenous Languages School, Gumbanga School, Coffs Harbour. So, yeah, I want to see more of that.
Great. Lorena?
Yeah, I was going to say language and cultural strength too, because that's where we get our hope and optimism from, is from our rich heritage and knowledge about who we are and how, in this country, and that's what language gives us. So I would love to see much more support for us to be able to speak language, to talk to our kids, and to have that more normalised in day-to-day life in Australia. That, you know, they talk about, they use our language all the time whenever they talk about the name of a town or the name of an animal, just recognising that is the language of this country and valuing it. I think that's what gives us optimism. Our history and our culture gives us hope.
Well, on a more personal level then, as we sum up the year in review, Lorena, I wonder if you could share with us your personal highlight of 2025 and what you'd like to do better in 2026.
Well, my personal highlight's got to be producing that series for The Guardian called The Descendants, which was a big project bringing together the descendants of all sides of frontier violence. We uncovered some extraordinary things. I was very proud of the work that we did there, and I think it will lead to, you know, hopefully lead to more meaningful work in the future. What I would do better in the future is lighten things up a bit. I think it's very easy when you work in the public sphere to focus on the negatives, and the news is pretty bleak and pretty overwhelming. So I think I would like to try and find more lightness and joy in the next year.
Lyndon?
Both a personal and professional highlight, doing the Close the Gap review and getting to go to Manangreeta, spend the week there. That mob is just so good, so awesome. Culture was everywhere, like first and foremost in their conversations. Some of them, because there's so many language groups around there, they speak up to 10, 12 languages, English coming in at 7, 8, thereabouts. And they were just the best people. Yeah, getting to spend a week in a community like that did a lot for me intellectually and for my soul. It was just really good. Next year, probably the same as I should have done this year. I've got to move more, exercise, get out and, yeah, get healthy.
Well, I shall keep an eye on both of you, both that you're exercising, Lyndon, and Lorena, that you're finding some joy and a little bit of happiness. Thank you both so much for once again guiding us through an insightful reflection on the year that was 2025, and would note that in both of your highlights of 2025 included significant work that you've done, important contributions to the community. So thank you for all the work you do outside of this studio as well.
And the same to you, Larissa. Yes. I'll take the opportunity to say thank you for holding this program week in, week out, and for, you know, privileging our voices every week.
Well, I'll allow you to say that, because I'll also acknowledge that you once hosted this show too, Lorena. So you held space for me. My guests have been journalist and industry professor Lorena Allam and director of research at the Jumbana Institute, Professor Lyndon Coombs. On this episode of Speaking Out, we're taking a look back at the past 12 months in Indigenous affairs. Coming up, producer Janaea Gibbs-Muir will take a look back at the year that was in sport. But first, some music from 3% with Better Man.
Yeah. I've walked the line a couple of times, seen the devil with my eyes, sort of knew where I was heading, so there wasn't no surprise. Lost the love of my life, really the love of my life. Life was giving me them hands, but my spirit couldn't fight. I was in and out, in between, sleepwalking, never dreamed. I was living, but not living, pill I swallow, bittersweet. Dead man walking, I see the morgue and I'm not scared. Love is a hell of a drug, nobody gets bit.
Can't let go, I'm stalling. Maybe two more shots, I'm calling.
I've been fighting for too long. I've been trying to beat what planks inside me, to heal what I've been hiding. Got the whole world on my shoulders, and that weight really got me tired. And these bad doors grow colder. I don't wanna burn no one with my fire. Truth hurts, but wounds heal. More scars gained from the battlefield. When they look down, I fight uphill. My pride aside, I'm trying still. Got no quit inside my DNA. It takes a better man to walk away, but a better one can hold the weight.
Can't let go, I'm stalling. Maybe two more shots, I'm calling.
That's music from 3% with Better Man. 2025 brought both challenges and triumphs for our communities. We navigated ongoing struggles while forging new pathways towards sovereignty, recognition, and healing. It was a big year in politics, but it was also a big year in sport. We've seen sporting codes across the nation celebrate the contributions of our First Nations athletes, who have again exceeded expectations, while also using the sport they love to give back to their communities. So here with me to reflect on the year of sport is Speaking Out producer and our resident sports girl, Janaea Gibbs-Muir. Janaea, thanks for coming into the studio with me.
Thanks for having me, Larissa.
Well, we're going to do a bit of an around the grounds here with your expertise, your eyes being on the ball, so to speak, throughout the year. The AFL brought back the Indigenous All-Stars game, which happened to coincide with the NRL All-Stars game weekend. What sort of impact do you think these big games have on our communities?
I think these games really kind of bring home like how important sport is in our communities and how they can actually give young people in our communities opportunities as well. And we also get to show off some of the big stars in both AFL and NRL. And I think this year it was really cool to see the AFL bring it back the same weekend as the NRL, because you can kind of like, because some people might be fans of AFL, but others might be fans of NRL. So you could kind of pick. And there was also like games both sides of Australia, because the AFL was held in Perth and then the NRL was based in New South Wales. But they both have different premises as well. Like with the NRL, for instance, it's the Maori All-Stars versus the Aboriginal All-Stars. So that kind of highlighted also the issues that are going on with our Maori mob at the moment. So that was a really good to kind of see and bring to light those issues as well. Whereas in the AFL, it was just a celebration of all the black players that we have in the AFL and never really got a chance to do an All-Stars yet. So it's the first time it was brought back in 10 years. The last time it was played, it was probably with the greats, so like Adam Goods and Michael O'Loughlin. So it was kind of good to see all the younger talent that are up and coming in that AFL as well.
Later in the year, we saw two sporting greats. One was honoured and the other retired. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so the great Matildas player, Lydia Williams, unfortunately retired back in August. She was one of the first Indigenous goalkeepers for the Matildas back in 2003. And her career has spanned across over 100 international games. And last year, she retired from the international game, and this year, she officially retired. And she has made massive contributions. She was one of the vital players when the Matildas were up and coming to get equal pay against the Socceroos as well. So she really pushed for those sorts of reforms in soccer. And she was also honoured as the Trailblazer of the Year at the National Indigenous Sports Awards as well. So she had a great career, and I'm so excited to see where she goes next with that. And Michael Long got the Lifetime Achievement Award at the NAIDOC Awards this year, which was a pretty big thing. We've seen his advocacy for equality within the sporting arena, but not just that, reconciliation overall here in Australia with his long walk that has been going for decades now. So I think that his contributions being recognised like this is really beautiful to see.
It's always lovely to talk about the wins and the celebrations, but we should also have a little bit of a dive into the controversies as well. It came out that current players in the AFL were dealing with online racism and discrimination. What were your thoughts about that situation?
I think my thoughts on the situation was more like the codes need to do better at protecting their players online. The situation that was pretty big this year was Nazeiah Wanganeen-Malira, who was a St Kilda player, and Port Adelaide's Jason Burgoyne. They both went off the field and actually looked at comments on their social media of people like calling them pretty much copping racial abuse. There needs to be more regulations online to protect players from that sort of stuff. And players, like when they speak out against that, they shouldn't be punished for speaking out. Also, Willy Rioli copped a lot of online abuse towards the end of his career, which he announced his retirement this year. That's a sad way to go out, because you shouldn't have to go out on those terms. I really kind of hope that the AFL does kind of listen to these players and just kind of realise that they need to do more to protect them from that sort of abuse.
The ABC series Endgame, hosted by Tony Armstrong, looked at solutions in sport around racism. What was your perspective on that, and how do you think we could address the issue?
I quite enjoyed the documentary. I thought Tony did a really good job at kind of going outside of Australia and showing us solutions to these issues. The online abuse, for instance, there is a whole platform in the UK where you can actually, as he says in the doco, turn off the tap on racial online abuse. And I think it'll be interesting to see how Brisbane Lions go with that trial. And I really hope that from that, other clubs can follow suit. But what I really liked about at the end of the documentary that we were going towards a solution with the Players Coalition. So the idea of it would be players coming together to advocate for law reform around racial and discriminatory abuse. And I think there needs to be that, and I hope that more players get on board. Throughout the doco, I think he asked Ash Gardner, who's a great cricket player and proud Maori woman, asked her to be a part of it, and she has happily said she will, and then another cricketer as well. So I really hope that we get more involvement from the bigger codes, because there was a good point in the doco is that our politicians love athletes. And if, like, athletes can use their platforms to make some changes, like, why not?
Of course, one of the biggest events on the calendar for especially New South Wales mob, whether they like football or not, is the Koorie Knockout, one of the most talked about events of the year on our calendar. You got to be there on the grounds. So can you tell us what were some of the big moments from that weekend?
Oh, yeah. It was a great weekend. It was really hot. I got sunburnt, so that was probably a moment. But I think one of the cool things I got to see was just all the young talent from like the under 16s and under coming through. Like, I think there was one team in the under 16s that was averaging 40 points every game. And I was like, I don't know how they're doing that. But it was also, I didn't see many like young girls games. And that's one of the things I was a bit disappointed about. Like we noticed throughout the weekend that all the young girls who were 16 and under, their games were on the backfield, which not that it would have been a big issue, but I just kind of noticed that was a big trend during that weekend. And it was a very hectic weekend of footy, lots of small communities coming together. We saw Bourke Warriors and the Newcastle Yowies in the finals, and Newcastle Yowies won. So that is a pretty big achievement. They won the women's and the men's, and then I think they won the under 15 girls as well. So they had three teams that won in the knockout, and it just kind of proves how much talent is coming out of that team. And what the future looks like for young women as well.
To the end of the year, we made history in the Ashes. How will that have an impact on the future of cricket, Janaya?
Yeah, so we had, for the first time in 157 years, we've had multiple Indigenous men be represented at the Ashes. So it was Scott Boland and Brendan Doggett. Everyone thought that Brendan Doggett wasn't going to be picked because he has only played for 1 year compared to Scott Boland. I think that it's going to encourage more young Indigenous people to want to go into cricket. I really hope so. And I think it'll just strengthen their pathways as well. There's so many like smaller programs in local communities that kids can access. And I just hope that it makes it more accessible for them to be able to grow the Indigenous representation in the sport.
That's producer Janaya Gibbs-Muir taking a look back at some of the key sporting moments of the past year. That's the show for the year. Join us again next time when we revisit some of my favourite conversations as part of our summer season. Speaking Out is produced by Janaya Gibbs-Muir and Nadine Haynes. Our senior producer is Jay McAllister. And as always, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or on social media via ABC Indigenous, along with our titter show Away, hosted by the fabulous Rudy Bremer. This week, Rudy takes a look back at the history of black burlesque. I, for one, will be tuning in for that one. I'm Larissa Berendt, and this is Speaking Out.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.